the second case, 99-1734, State v. Trani and Henin. Is it Dismook? Dismook, okay. We will hear Mr. Martin from you, representing Mr. Dismook. Mr. Becker, we welcome you back.
Good morning. My name is still Richard Martin, and I represent the defendant, appellant petitioner, Trani Dismook. This case is before the court on the issue of what costs, if any, a defendant can be assessed, properly assessed, for being transported to and from his own court appearances from the prison system. And I think there are really only three problematic areas in the Court of Appeals decision. It's handling of facts, it's legal analysis, and the result. At the outset,
is there anything left?
Well, those are the only three I could find. There's a lot of good language in there, but it's just those three things that trouble me. At the outset, it's important to state, I think, that even if the state's correct on the fundamental question, which is what can a defendant be made to pay something concerning the costs, does this record support what was ordered here and what the trial court upheld and what the Court of Appeals affirmed? And what I found really striking, and again, I said this earlier, I don't practice civil law, but what struck me as really striking was almost entirely lacking from either the trial court or the Court of Appeals decision is any recognition of fundamental principles that courts always apply when taxing costs. Costs aren't automatically taxed. A party doesn't just submit a bill and get a court to say, that's what's to be taxed. There are procedures, and there are principles, and there's a body of law, and there's common sense, and this is a case I cite in my brief that says there's fairness involved. So all these things are just missing from this decision here. And most importantly, when a trial court taxes costs, it exercises its discretion, both in the amount and what items will or won't be allowed. Civil lawyers know this all the time. When they litigate a case, they have to figure out, can I get reimbursed for this deposition? Is this travel expense reasonable? Can I call 11 experts when the court's only going to let me tax costs for three? I mean, that's something that in the real world happens in civil law every day. But somehow here in criminal law, the lower courts seem to think that someone submits a piece of paper that's got a number on it, and you pay it without any question.
Can I ask a question?
I hope so.
We know that if you say it's facts and it's common sense, here the court had a bill of around $1,500, as I understand, on a piece of paper, and it was reduced to, say, $973. Did the court use its discretion there? What resulted in the different amounts?
That's a very interesting question, and it's one of the more unusual and I think very troubling aspects of this. What happened is, as I read the record of sentencing, the judge just said all applicable costs. Some functionary in the clerk of court's office picked up the file, took that judgment roll, added up a bunch of orders, and came up with that $900-some-dollar number. Mr. Coleman, my predecessor counsel, filed the post-conviction motion, the first one, challenging for all sorts of legal and constitutional reasons that assessment at all. Judge Dugan looked at the motion, and even before receiving the reply brief, which came in as scheduled, issued an order denying the motion and noting, by the way, I've added up these numbers and it's more than 900, it's 15-something. I direct the clerk of courts to up it to 15-something. Mr. Coleman sent an amended motion saying, you know, excuse me, first of all, my reply brief, you didn't even look at it. Secondly, you haven't explained why you're upping it. And rather than then set the matter for a hearing or discuss why it was being upped, Judge Dugan said, okay, never mind, go back to the 900, which to me is inscrutable is one word, I guess, that comes to mind. There's no clear basis why the 9, why the 1500. It wasn't discretion. It was, well, this is a good number. Well, how about that number? No, we'll go back to this number. I mean, that's my reading of the record. I hope I'm not being uncharitable, but that's sort of the way it reads in this record.
Well, my reading was, and I wasn't sure, and that's why I asked the question, was the judge, knowing that there were X number of trips back and forth from Waupun to Milwaukee, gave a factor that it used some discretion as far as the value of that.
Well, you know, we don't know because the record's silent what his reasons were. Certainly, that could have been in the back of his mind. But the problem is, there's no correspondence where he's no corresponding indication. Well, I'm disallowing these particular trips because these adjournments weren't the defendant's fault, and therefore I'm striking these trips, which takes it, you know, because he took one number, then he took another, went back to the first. And, you know, one of Mr. Becker's arguments, I believe, is that Mr. Disney oughtn't be complaining because even under his own construction, he didn't get charged for all those trips. But the other side of that coin is, if the sheriff is really submitting these claims and expecting to be paid, the very fact that they're treated so cavalierly and casually shows that nobody really expects these to be paid at all. I think the strange thing here is, as you read this record and you look at it, it's not an Indiana Jones movie, but it's very strange because you keep trying to figure out who is doing what. Why does the left hand and the right hand not communicate? Why does the sheriff's lawyer, the court counsel, not know what the sheriff's practice is? Why does the clerk of courts contradict that? How can the Court of Appeals characterize a letter from an accountant as a letter brief, a submission by a non-lawyer? How can a trial court make any sort of findings when the facts are hopelessly contradictory?
I have another question in that area.
Are you finished?
That is.
I want to interrupt you.
I think that the length of questioning on this court will probably stand on its own. I think I can ask two questions in a row. The next one has to do with the ultimate collectability. If your client is put on parole, say for example he's paroled, is this a collectible cost to him? Is that the ultimate, let's say that he would be responsible for this?
Yes, it is, and the answer to that is a little complicated if you bear with me for a moment, because I was looking again at the statutes. As I read the statutes, 973, I think it's 07, it can become a 6-month jail sentence consecutive to the other sentences if he doesn't pay in the abstract. However, another section of 973.06 says if both costs and restitution are ordered simultaneously, then it gets folded into one amount, and then it can become a condition of parole and or probation. Conceivably, a person could be extended for periods of time. And I do know the institutions are fairly aggressive about deducting 25% of the inmate's wages, you know, on a monthly or weekly basis to pay costs, surcharges, fines, restitution.
So what I was getting at is that when we're talking about whether which entity in the county pays for this, and it makes no difference here if it is truly a cost to the defendant, your client, that that would might make a difference as far as who ultimately would be paid. That was really
right. And the answer,
yeah.
I'm sorry, the answer is yes, there are consequences. Yes, the client may ultimately pay some or all. Yes, he could be conceivably given 6 months in the House of Correction for not paying, because I checked the judgment of conviction here, there was no restitution ordered, so it doesn't fold into for this defendant. But for a defendant who had both restitution and a cost, as I read the statutes, then it could be folded into one obligation, which could be a condition of supervision, and could be a basis for extensions of supervision, and so on. So this could be following someone for years.
Yeah, thank you.
Counsel, your brief asks at the end that either we reflect court costs of $20, which is what?
The service, there's a $20 fee. I'm sorry, it's been a while.
Maybe it was the CCAP fee. I can't remember.
I can't
anyway,
remember.
It was a particular fee.
Right.
That's what you're asking
right.
for. And then your alternative is to remand for further fact-finding. Okay. If we should remand for further fact-finding, then what principle of law do we direct the circuit court to look at? I mean, we got a legal issue here, maybe, as to precisely what is covered under, and I'm going to fumble around now, under the statute, what is it, 807?
The cost statute is 973.06, and the sheriff's fees is 814.70.
That's, okay. So, what do we have to say what that is, or is that just an advisory opinion when you don't know what the facts are? Because it may be that when you find out what the facts are, this whole issue of costs goes away.
Right. Well, that is, you know, the more I thought about this case, the more I'm convinced there has to be some sort of remand. I can't just win outright. And I also think that you have to enunciate some principles for the trial court to be guided by, which is what you're asking me. And what are those principles? I think several come into play. First, the sheriff's office has to come forward and prove up the costs. How the costs were figured, where this 70 cents a mile comes in. This is one of the most troubling aspects of this case. The statute says 25 cents a mile, or the county board can set a higher fee. The Court of Appeals, in one of its many assumptions and conjectures and speculations, says, well, we assume the county board set a higher fee. I've combed Milwaukee County ordinances. I know my opposing counsel has. If there was an ordinance doing that, it would be before this court. So
that we could take judicial notice.
That there isn't one. I mean, you could. I assume so, yes. I hadn't thought of it that way. But the point is, if someone is going to claim a right to 70 cents, which is clearly almost triple the statute, it just seems that they should have to show where it comes from. Because the place it can come from is a county ordinance.
But that was all under 814.70, fees of sheriffs, right?
Right.
And that pertains to service of process, right?
Right, and one thing that maybe helped this court in analyzing my brief is that there were several contentions advanced in the Court of Appeals by my predecessor counsel, which I have abandoned. He argued that serving an order to produce wasn't what the statute meant by service of process. The Court of Appeals rejected that, and I didn't think it was a defensible position I could articulate here. I'm willing to concede that serving an order to produce is serving process. He argued that the sheriff could serve it by mail or fax. I'm willing to concede they have a right to serve it personally for lots of good reasons.
Do they serve it and then at the same time take the prisoner? So it's a one-shot
deal. It is a one-shot deal, but as I understand, they have to call first and give oral notice we're coming to get him.
But there's no charge for moving the prisoner down. The prisoner is not charged for the moving.
Well, that's part of what you said. The mileage charge is, well,
isn't it serving?
Well, that's an interesting question because the statute also allows for costs and disbursements of a conveyance of the prisoner, which as I would read it would mean you got a long trip, you stay overnight in a hotel, or you put him in a county jail where they charge you $30 a night, or you got a meal at the McDonald's. Those kinds of out-of-pocket things, costs and disbursements, are clearly embraced by the statute. The fee, I mean, in a sense, the fee is for the service, but as an incident of that, you're bringing the person back.
Why is the service of process at all? And I'm puzzled by why you would concede that argument here. If this isn't the sheriff delivering a court order from one party to another, that's service of process. This is the sheriff executing an order of the court, which is directed to the sheriff to go get this guy from prison, and it's a order also directed to the warden saying, release this guy to the sheriff so he can bring him to me. You know, that's what the trial judge is saying. So this is the execution of an order by the sheriff's department. This isn't service of process at all.
But if you look at the list of things that are service of process, one of them is subpoena, it's very broad, other order. And how is this different from this? It's basically a forcible subpoena. I mean, you're under force of arms, you're subpoenaing the person and bringing their body to the court. And these orders to produce were signed by a court commissioner, but it's a court that's given us imprimatur. I'd be glad to withdraw my concession. I doubt that you'll get away with it, but I'd be glad to withdraw that and say you can't charge them anything. I mean, there are people in my office who think I should argue that. But I just, reading that statute the way it's written, and looking at the whole context of the statute, which talks about the cost of conveyance of a prisoner, and talks about charging for bringing someone back to another state, and there's a case on that, I think it may be Bender. It's clear the legislature laid out certain costs the sheriff can charge. There's another question. The sheriff can charge it, but who pays? That's the other question here. The sheriff can say, these are my fees, but this goes to the court's discretion. Is the county of Milwaukee pay it, or Racine, or Dane, or is it the defendant?
Or the defendant.
The defendant.
So let's talk about that. One of your arguments was equal protection, right?
Right.
Suppose maybe this isn't the facts, I'll ask it this way. Is it ever somebody other than the defendant who pays? I mean, is it the DA's office? Is it the clerk of circuit court? Is it the circuit court itself that sometimes pays these fees? Because this is a matter of shifting fees from the sheriff's budget to someone else.
Right.
So if I read your argument, which has your constitutional arguments, which have other problems, do we know who pays these fees generally?
Well, yes and no. Apart from the constitutional, just to address the factual matter, not the constitutional aspect of it.
Don't address it.
The interesting thing in this record is that if the talismanic phrase, indigent defendant, is typed on the order, which is what defense attorneys routinely do in Milwaukee County, then the sheriff submits that, and the clerk of circuit courts has some sort of segregated fund from which they get paid right away. So someone has funded put money in a fund for indigent defendants who have that on their order, and the county pays it. I mean, the irony here is that the sheriff, I think, routinely submits these orders with very little expectation of being paid, except in those cases where the defense attorney prepares it, and it's got that phrase on there, and then the clerk of courts disperses it.
But that's just saying the county pays itself, right?
Well, the money comes from the clerk of courts and goes to the sheriff's. Yeah, right, that's the other...
Yeah, it's just a paper thing.
Exactly. That's the other... I mean, that's what is so troubling. This is all a matter of one unit of government billing another all within the same county. And I'm not sure what, greater minds than the mind have established that in.
Say the public defender's office wants to talk to the client, doesn't want to go up to the prison. Do you ever have an order to bring the prisoner down so you can talk to him?
No, we go see them in person.
And who pays for that?
It comes out of our budget.
Okay, that's a state budget. Do you ever charge it to the client?
No. Now, we do have a separate agreement with the Division of Corrections when the client's placed out of state, where there's some cost sharing, where the Division of Corrections pays part of that cost, and we pay for part of it to travel to Tennessee or Oklahoma. I'm sorry?
There's something in this about the cost for bringing him from another state.
As I read that, and I looked at that statute a couple times, that statute was drafted and has been in the books long before we started wholesale exporting prisoners, and as I read that, it had to do with going and bringing back someone who's been extradited or in some ways out of the jurisdiction. It wasn't contemplating bringing people back here, and as I understand it, corrections practice is they bring them from out of state back to Dodge when there's a need to bring them back as a witness or a defendant or for some court proceeding, and so there's corrections doing that, and then the sheriff of the county goes to Dodge to get them. Right. That raises, the question about who pays when I go see somebody raises an interesting question in my mind. If I go on a prison trip, I typically go to two or three prisons in a day and a half, 2 days, and see six, seven, eight defendants up the Fox Valley or over Northwest. And I send an expense voucher to list how many miles I went, and I get reimbursed on a mileage basis. If I tried to claim mileage for each trip, but to each defendant, when it's a one unified trip, 300-mile trip, and I get the mileage for that. If I tried to claim it for each defendant, it would be called fraud. But if a sheriff does it and wants to get mileage for picking up five guys up the Fox Valley or three people over at Columbia Correctional and wants to get 70 cents per mile per defendant, the Court of Appeals says that's fine.
Would that have to counsel with the condition of the cost providing some type of security, etc., or don't you think that would be figured in? What you're doing, you're going as an individual and visiting people at the institution. What I'm not trying to argue this, but they're actually bringing the person and providing a quote service over and above the mere transportation because of the security and the cost of the officer and things of that nature.
No, that's a valid point, and I don't disagree with that. My point is just that there are economies of scale. When you pick up five people, it doesn't cost five times what it picks up.
Sure.
It costs to pick up one. And my reading of the policy behind both this cost statute and the cost statutes in general is, as I said kind of colorfully in my brief, it's cost. It's not a profit. sheriff isn't running a transportation service by which they can make $3.50 a mile or $4.20 a mile or whatever times 70 cents. That's not what the statute contemplates, and that's what's troubling about this, is that if you read the Court of Appeals decision, it approves that. It basically says you can charge each of these guys 70 cents a mile, even though in Milwaukee County's practice, and I don't pretend to be intimately familiar with it, but I know there are regular runs made to the various prisons on certain days of the week. There are attempts not to have prisoners in the jail over the weekend because of the crowding, and so there are plans to be as efficient as possible. If you start shifting all these costs to defendants, it reduces the systemic incentive to be efficient. If the sheriff can go willy-nilly and pick up people already once, knowing he'll get 70 cents a mile, there's no incentive.
Mr. Martin, does the record reflect that this is just a Milwaukee County problem, or is this a statewide issue? Are other counties doing the same thing that Milwaukee County is doing?
I don't know. And that's the short answer. All I know is the record in this case. And I don't know, the other case I've got was there's a bypass pending here. I think it's Edwards is also a Milwaukee case.
Well, that's what I wanted to talk about. That raises the constitutional issues here. Is that right? That's referred to on your brief. Let's see, pages 28, 29. So
right.
That's pending on a bypass that raises the constitutional issues
right.
That at least the state says are not in this case.
Right.
Which I want to go back to the question about remand here. And it goes back again to whether the court just says, look, this is a record that the facts are unclear, what the procedures in the various, quote, county departments is unclear. Go back and let us have the facts, and then we'll look at the statute, because you can't just look at the statute without facts. Another way of looking at this is to say, sure, we may need more facts, but that the court is going to enunciate principles to guide what facts are relevant, right?
Correct.
So what I asked you before is, what principles do you think should be enunciated? I mean,
sure.
I can see it either way or different ways, and Mr. Becker is going to persuade us. We don't even have to deal with any
right.
of this. So what are the principles that should govern him?
And I apologize. I think we got sidetracked and I never really gave an answer.
That's all right.
The first principle is the person seeking the costs has to prove them up in some fashion, has to come forward and show, here are the costs, here is how we calculate them, here's the basis upon which they're calculated, and here is what our costs were in transporting this defendant. And the somewhat knotty question connected with that is how many other defendants were transported on these various runs, because if you've got a van with 5, 6, 7 people, I think it does have an effect on what is a reasonable and necessary disbursement, because the statutes talk about reasonable and necessary costs. So one principle is, what were the costs? 2, how are they assessed? 3, were they reasonable and necessary? I think it's a statutory principle. So those are the first three. And then kicks in what I alluded to at the outset, which is the court's overarching duty to make a determination of what's fair.
Do you possibly think if each time there's a hearing on this, that should be part of the case that they should bring in, that it costs X number of dollars to run? This is the expense in the sheriff's office. This is the cost of each individual.
Are you asking me if Mr. Disney should pay for the remand hearing too, or are you asking me?
No, I'm just asking. You're indicating that this would be a normal and reasonable question and answer period during this hearing on costs.
I see, yes. And I think the sheriff is in a position to know some facts, but not all. The sheriff's in a position to show what trips were made and the mileage and so on. The sheriff's in no position to know if the defendant was responsible for the adjournment or not. And I don't place that burden on him. I think that another thing that struck me about this case is the case is captioned State of Wisconsin versus Trani M. Dismuke. The DA never said a word. The DA never responded to Judge Dugan's request for a briefing. The DA, who represents the state, has never made any claim for costs here. What you've got is the transport service, the sheriff's office making a claim, the middle person, I start to say middle man, but I guess it can't anymore, the middle person, the clerk of courts, administering this pot of money, but the other party's never made a claim for costs. But the point I'm making sort of circuitously here is that the state then would have some burden through the offices of the DA to say these are the costs that we think are fairly accessible. And we recognize that there were three of those adjournments that were our fault, and we're not going to ask you to assess those costs, because that wouldn't be right. I'm not saying a specific number here, but in general terms. A court could say, I recognize that twice I had to adjourn this trial because I couldn't be here. I was sick. I was in another trial. I'm not going to assess those costs. That's what happens in a different context, in a different manner in civil cases. A party says, these are my costs. And the opposing party says, well, it's not reasonable to make us bear that cost because you shouldn't have reasonably expected to get reimbursed for it. Or it is. And that's the kind of give and take that has to go on here. And it kind of requires notice in a hearing, which is what was not here either. So I guess the principles are, what were the costs of the sheriff, or how were they calculated? What other trips may have been made? Those are the three things the sheriff can come forward with. And the state, I think, has a burden to say, these are the ones we're seeking. This is what we think is reasonable to exact from this defendant. And then the judge has this very important duty of making a final call. What's reasonable? What's exercising discretion? What's reasonable to tax on this defendant in this case? And what's proportionate to this case? I mean, you can have a civil case where one party runs up costs far in excess of the value of the claim. And a judge is going to say, well, you may have spent that money, but I'm not going to tax those costs because you knew this claim was worth $3,000 and you run up $14,000 in costs.
The thing is, so, we're going to have an order to produce the defendant from prison to come in for that hearing on costs.
And he'll have to pay it. Yeah. Yeah. Well, he might be willing to pay part of it.
So you don't contemplate this happening at sentencing? I mean, the way...
That's a very interesting... Another part... Yes, I mean, it should. That's the other thing. If there's a case that I just discovered, it had to do with the cost for attorney's fees, and I've got it, I can give you the site when I sit down, I'll give it to you on a rebuttal, but there's a case where the court assessed attorney's fees, a court of appeals case, and the court specifically said it's got to be done at sentencing, because there's language within that subsection of the statute that says it's a sentencing function. And what happened there was, my time was up, the DA came in later and asked for an amendment to add these attorney's fees. Court of appeals said, no, it's too late. So it is a sentencing function, but it's analogous to restitution, and I can see it being a sentencing function that's somewhat drawn out, potentially. Which, again, brings up questions of common sense. How much time do we want to spend litigating? The ordinary case is not going to be these kind of numbers. It's going to be a much smaller number. My time is up.
Yeah, well, your time is up, but we'd let you go away without once mentioning the Ferguson case. Why do you think it's applied? Why do you think it's applicable here?
Well, because I think the principle of Ferguson was defendants don't pay overhead. They don't pay the ordinary expenses of law enforcement. That is, the sheriff is elected and his deputies are hired to do certain functions, and that is a cost the taxpayers pay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Becker?
May it please the court. My name is Assistant Attorney General David Becker, and I appear here today on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. I'm not sure where to begin. I think one general comment is in order, and that is I don't think that the trial court in this case or the Court of Appeals, were they sitting here, would recognize this case, because as this case has been argued and comes before this court, I think the ground has completely shifted out from under us by comparison to where we stood when we were in the trial court and when we were in the Court of Appeals. As I read all the submissions that were made by the defendant in the trial court and in the Court of Appeals, he was arguing that either these sort of costs are simply not authorized at all by statute, or else if they are, their imposition in this case was unconstitutional. What I seem to be hearing here today, as the primary argument that's being made, is that we should send this back for some sort of exercise of discretion. That seems to me, like I say, to be completely different, a completely different case from what was presented to the trial court and the Court of Appeals. The trial court was not asked to exercise its discretion. The defendant didn't make his motion under the subsection of the cost statute that allows a trial court to remit costs and say, judge, exercise your discretion under that statute and don't charge me for the times I was brought down when court congestion kept us from having a trial or when the DA's office wasn't prepared to proceed. What he argued was these kinds of costs are simply not authorized by statute, and if they are, their imposition here was unconstitutional. Well, if we return to those fundamental issues that were the issues in this case until we came into this court, I don't think that there's any question but that we are talking here about costs that are properly assessed in a criminal case. And the cost statute in a criminal case clearly says that that the cost shall consist of the following items and no others. The necessary disbursements, forget about disbursements, we're not relying on that word, and here's the critical language, fees of officers allowed by law and also incurred in connection with the arrest, preliminary examination, trial of the defendant. I don't think there's a dispute here that these were costs, or fees rather, that were incurred in connection with the arrest, preliminary examination, and trial of the defendant. So I think we have to focus ourselves on the critical words, fees of officers allowed by law. And so we look to see what fees are allowed by law, and we simply turn to 81470, which specifically is entitled in bold letters, Fees of Sheriffs. And then it describes the fees of sheriffs, and one is a fee for service of process. In that section, process specifically being described as summons or any other process for commencement of an action, a writ, an order or injunction, a subpoena, or any other order. And then later on in that same statute, we have a fee for travel, specifically in connection with criminal process, for travel and serving any criminal process. And then we have three subsections. The critical one here is that there can be a fee imposed of 25 cents per mile if the process is served outside the county, which is what we're dealing with here. And there, of course, is the following section of the statutes that talks about the county board being able to establish a higher fee. So it seems to me beyond dispute, and I don't really know that it is being disputed here today, that the fees the sheriff entered on the returns of these orders to produce are fees that are covered by 81470, because it specifically indicated a fee for service, and that would be the service of process fee, 81470 sub 1, and then it also indicated a fee for travel, and that would be the 81470 sub 4, travel criminal process. So it seems...
Under your statutory definition, let's look at this fee for process. So if the sheriff's department had an arrest warrant in Milwaukee and thought they could got a tip and they went to the person's house and wasn't there, and then went to his employment and he wasn't there, and the next day they got a tip that maybe he was going to be at the McDonald's on 74th, and they went there and he wasn't there, and finally they found him, you know, at the state fair or something. Would they be able to incur to under your definition of fees of sheriff, service of process, 81470 along with 97306, be able to charge for the service
for that arrest warrant.
All those trips that turned out to be futile?
Well, they were trying to serve arrest under your definition.
Well,
who cares if you're futile? Apparently, there were 8 or 9 different adjourned trials here. Some of those transports were futile, trips were futile. So I don't think that comes into it. Futility, the issue of futility might be reserved for another case, but not this one.
Well, some suggestion why this says attempted service.
Yeah, okay. So my question is, under your statutory definitions, is that a properly charged fee of the sheriff?
It would seem so. I mean,
that's what I think so, too.
Thought about it, and it would seem so. So what we have here is, I think, a case in which clearly these charges are properly fall within the statutory definition of fees. Let me get that exact statutory language again. Fees of officers allowed by law. I mean, I don't say I have to be more clear when we have a statute that specifically sets these up as fees. I mean, these are clearly fees allowed by law.
Maybe I should follow up my question, because maybe it isn't as obvious as I thought it might be. And that is, boy, that seems real ridiculous. That the sheriff would be able to charge for the service of process for an arrest. I'm talking about insulting injury, you know, for an arrest.
Well, it doesn't strike...
It doesn't strike you as ridiculous.
Not particularly when we realize that we do not impose costs until the defendant is convicted. I'm not sure it's adding insult to injury when we have arrested a man that is found guilty after a jury trial. I think that that seems to me to be perfectly reasonable.
How do you distinguish it from Ferguson, then? That isn't this just the cost of doing business in the state justice system, and that you should not be parceling this out to, quote, users, especially involuntary users of the criminal justice system.
Yeah, and I think in the absence of 8-1470, there's no question that Ferguson would come into play here, and I think Ferguson and a whole line of other cases that talk and make exactly the point that you have just made. And in particular, I think what would be happening in that situation, absent 8-1470, is the state would be trying to say, well, these are disbursements, and Ferguson and these other cases would come in and say, no, it's not disbursements when it's just the ordinary cost of paying the public employees to do what they are assigned to do. But then when
he's arrested, do they charge a travel fee at 70 cents a mile to bring him back? Is that under your statutory definition also something that's allowed?
If the service fee is allowed, the travel fee would have to be allowed.
Well, this goes to the fundamental question of what is service of process. And I grant you that the statute 81470 includes the phrase "or any other order." So the question becomes, what is service of an order? And an order to produce is not being served by the sheriff when the sheriff obeys its commands. I mean, this is an order to produce is an order to the sheriff to do something. It's not an order to somebody else that the sheriff is merely serving. It's directed to the warden saying, release this guy to the custody of the sheriff, and it's directed to the sheriff saying, you must go and get him and bring him here and then return him back. So the sheriff is being ordered to do something by the judge or the court commissioner, by the court. And so it seems to me that in order to produce, that this is the execution of a court order, which is directed specifically to the sheriff and to the warden. This is not mere service of process. It's not service of a court order.
Well, first of all, just in the...
That gets to the arrest warrant example that Justice Bradley was giving to, because because I think an arrest warrant falls in the same category of thing. It tells the sheriff or the law enforcement agency to go out and get this person and bring him to
court. Okay. And as I think I indicated in response here, I hadn't really thought about that, and that may be that an arrest warrant is something different. But I think, so I'm just not prepared to say that you're wrong with respect to the arrest warrant. But I will say, with respect to this order to produce, there is no this order to produce is primarily, if not exclusively, but certainly primarily directed to the warden or the person who has physical custody of the inmate. I'm looking at a copy of it. It starts off with a whereas clause that something is coming up and this person must be present, and then it says, now therefore it is ordered that, and it doesn't say order the sheriff to go up and get him, it is ordered that Gary McCautry or any other, I'm reading from one of the orders produced in this case, or any other superintendent who has physical custody of the named inmate, make available to the sheriff of Milwaukee County the above named defendant, and that the sheriff of Milwaukee County convey him or her. They were starting to talk to bring the sheriff into play, but the primary purpose of this is to order that the superintendent release this person, and it seems to me that that is a process under the broad definition of process.
But it does much more than that. It doesn't just compel the warden to release the defendant, it compels the sheriff to go get him. So the sheriff is merely executing an order of the court. He's not serving process. He's doing what the court is ordering to do. Go get this guy, bring him here, and then take him back.
Well, this, of course, as Mr. Martin has candidly admitted, is not what he is arguing in this court. The definition of process I don't remember if we got into this issue in this yes. At page 6 of my brief in this court, I quoted from an earlier decision of this court that says, as stated in respect to the word process, it is frequently used to designate a means, by writ or otherwise, of acquiring jurisdiction of a defendant or his property, or of bringing defendant into, or compelling him to appear in court to answer. And it seems to me that whoever this is directed at, the fact is, this is a means by which we bring a defendant into court. And it seems to me that that falls clearly within the definition of process as this court defined it in that decision that I'm quoting from at page 6 of our brief. Now, if I'm wrong in that, obviously 81470 falls by the boards, and then I fall under Ferguson and all of these other cases that I cannot attempt to justify these charges on the basis that somehow the sheriff's office has done some sort of cost accounting for its operations and says that we have figured out that it basically costs us in terms of the equipment and the personnel and what have you so much money to go up and bring a prisoner back. I don't think on the basis of existing case law I can make an argument that we can assess costs if they are imposed on that sort of a basis. They have to be imposed because they are fees authorized by law or whatever that magic language is there. Fees of officers allowed by law. And the only place I can go to find these fees allowed by law is 81470. If that doesn't cover the situation, if you're right, then these were improperly charged. But our position is that this is the service of process. I think the case law supports it. The Court of Appeals obviously had no problem with it, and specifically concluded that this was indeed criminal process. And although my opponent would obviously like to withdraw the concession and put this issue into play, and I guess it is into play. You'll have to decide it. The fact is, he didn't even argue it here in this court.
Can I interrupt you for just a minute? I was thinking about the way things work on the civil side when you tax costs. Usually what happens is there's a bill of costs submitted to the court. A copy goes to the other side. There's then the taxing of costs, which occurs in the clerk's office. People can appear and object. The statute provides that if there's an objection to the taxing of the costs requested, there can be a hearing before the circuit judge. Now, in this particular situation, as I understand it, we've got costs being taxed or assessed without a hearing, without notice, without any opportunity to be heard. Doesn't that strike you as somewhat violative of the idea of due process?
Well, again, I'm going to say, I don't think this was the issue that was ever raised in the trial court or the court of appeals. I'm not familiar enough with the Edwards record to know whether that is even raised.
It's certainly raised in the briefs of counsel and the arguments of counsel before this court.
Yeah. I'm not even sure of that. It's arguments this morning. I'm not so sure that it's in the briefs,
that the constitutional arguments have been waived. That's your position.
Yeah. With this particular one, it seems to me that the clerk, that this is basically an administrative function, and that, I mean, that's how it's treated, at least in this case, that the judge says that we're going to assess the applicable costs, and the clerk knows what those costs are and goes through the file to see if...
Let me put it another way. Don't we have a situation where there's now an objection to the costs that were assessed against the defendant? Should the defendant not have some opportunity to be heard before the trial court in regard to that assessment of costs?
He should be, if the objection that was made was one that required a hearing. And first of all, it depends on your definition of hearing. I mean, he certainly was heard in the sense of he made his submissions, he submitted his documentation, he made his arguments, and the judge concluded that they didn't have any merit. And the main reason for that being that his arguments were, as I described them earlier, basically ones that were arguments of law, that these weren't authorized. Read through the brief. Now, there may be some, I think in my opponent's reply brief, he quoted from some, from the conclusion of one of the briefs that was submitted to the trial court that paints with a very broad stroke in terms of the attack on these, but I think that the attack on these costs. And I think my opponent would argue that that subsumes all the attacks that were possible, including the ones that are now being raised here. But I would submit that that has to be read against the backdrop of what he had specifically pointed out as reasons why he felt the court couldn't impose the costs it did. And he never made the kind of argument about now that there should have been a hearing before.
Counsel, on that issue, the Court of Appeals, of course,
the ones that were made there, yes.
In its discussion, I think, on pages 14, 15, and 16. Now, what? I only read it once, and I'm taking a quick look at it again. But it seemed to me a disconnect. I remember when I read it that they were treating it as a facial challenge. On page 15, I noted when they were citing the language from the St. Francis Hospital case, they were treating it as though this were a facial challenge. That is, the court starts with the presumption that a statute is constitutional and will continue to preserve a statute's constitutionality if there's a reasonable basis for the exercise of legislative power. And yet, to me, this was clearly as applied challenge in terms of constitutional, or it seemed to me that it was. I guess, first of all...
I think I noticed that same disconnect you're talking about, but in terms of the analysis that they went on to apply, I think they answered the challenge that was made.
Just say no was kind of... No.
Well...
Maybe I'm wrong. That's unfair of me. That's right. They engaged in
several pages. It's just been a while since.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think when I reviewed that decision within the last 24 hours for purposes of preparation here, I was thinking, I'm not sure.
That
framework, but then they went on to specifically consider the individual due process and equal protection challenges, and I think properly rejected them because he was claiming that he was treated differently from people who are in county custody.
Okay, but
well, obviously, you know, there's
due process
difference.
Challenge.
Well, the due process challenge was that he shouldn't be, and this one has been raised again, I think this morning, and he's been consistent on that on this particular one, and that is that it's fundamentally unfair for him to be charged for appearances that he wasn't responsible for, and we could sit here forever and debate the fairness of that in its most basic sense. And if we were sitting at the legislature, we could possibly create some exceptions that would take into account those problems. But the question for purposes of due process is basically one of whether or not this, you know, shocks the conscience. And it certainly doesn't shock the conscience, I don't think, to impose on a criminal defendant the normal and ordinary costs incident to the ordinary and usual conduct of criminal proceedings, which includes adjournments that aren't always his fault.
Their clinching rationale with regard to due process, as I saw it, was on paragraph 29, and it said, in this matter, Dismuke was in state prison because he was found guilty of a crime. His actions brought about the additional costs. His confinement was a direct result of his unlawful conduct, and thus it cannot be argued that he played no part in generating the costs. And I thought they were saying, I thought, he was naughty.
notice the very first sentence of paragraph 29, and where they say exactly what I just said. Substantive due process prohibits a state court from engaging in conduct that shocks the conscience or interferes with rights implicit in the concept of ordered liberty, and nobody's suggesting that we're talking about rights implicit in the concept of ordered liberty, I don't think. And so the question was, shocks the conscience? And they were saying, it doesn't shock our conscience. He was, he was responsible for the situation that he was in, and there's no reason why we can't charge him for costs associated with the ordinary course of criminal proceedings, which includes adjournments that aren't his fault, that the system cannot accommodate the trial.
This statute, 814.70, also uses the word service, which has a defined meaning in the civil code. It says for each service or attempted service, and it not only says summons or commencement of order, but it says or any other order.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. Now, suppose that what the Sheriff's Department does is send up a bunch of orders saying, we've been ordered to pick up Joe Smith, and tells the prison when they're going to pick up Joe Smith here, Mr. Dismuke, right? Does it by mail. Would that be adequate service under the statute of this this order on the warden?
Well, it would be adequate in the technical legal sense.
Yeah.
Perhaps the fact of the matter is the practical matter. You can't serve this kind of an order in that manner because the order is that the defendant is supposed to be made available by the recipient of the order.
So
you serve it in person as a practical matter. That's the only reasonable way, really, in which you can do it.
Well, you can mail them all up and say, make them available, and I'm coming. It'll cover a letter and say, I'm coming on Thursday or whatever day they're coming. And then they drive the van up to the institution and drive back with the prisoner. Is that travel time of moving the prisoner covered here? I mean, can they charge the prisoner for that? I
don't think that falls within 814.70, absent the fact that it was in conjunction with the service of the process.
So the reason they can charge him for the transportation is because at the same time as they're going to pick up the prisoner, they've got the paperwork with them.
I think that's how one has to read the 814.70. Yeah.
how do you, I thought you read it differently. I thought you were going to say yes, because I thought you argued that 81470 sub 4, maybe it wasn't under 4.
Have service of,
For travel and serving any criminal process.
Got to get under 1 in order for you, in order for the state to win, if I understood the argument. You've got to come under 814.70 (1). Otherwise, you are in general disbursements, which at the Fug Ferguson you can't do. But maybe
I understood
you to be arguing, I'm sorry, for travel under 973.06 1A, that language that dealt with the fees and disbursements of the agent appointed to return a defendant from another state or county. And you were saying it's not so limited that this kind of language, maybe as the Court of Appeals was saying, as one of you, the state of the Court of Appeals was interpreting this to mean that includes, you know, intrastate, not just outside the state. That's not your interpretation.
No.
Your interpretation of 1A 973.06 is for situations where there's extradition and they're going out of state. Is that correct?
The last phrase that you're talking about, the fees and disbursements of the agent appointed to return a defendant from another state or country.
Yeah.
That has no application here whatsoever, because you're absolutely right. It's limited to that.
Okay.
The argument that the Court of Appeals was responding to of the defendant was that this was all the statute covered, and that these words, that this phrase that actually begins a few words back with the word including, were words of limitation, and that you could only get fees and disbursements for returning a defendant if you were returning him from another state or country. And the Court of Appeals quite properly recognized that under Wisconsin case law, the word including is a word of enlargement, not a word of contraction. And that was enlarging the fees that could be charged and not contracting them, and therefore we could properly rely on the earlier language, fees of officers allowed by law, look to 81470 and find the fees of sheriffs, and thereby allow the assessment of those fees.
Mr. Becker, Mr. Martin was asked whether this was a situation confined to Milwaukee. Do you have any information whether this is state?
No, my answer is exactly the same as his. My knowledge of this whole problem is confined to the record of this case, and I have no idea what's going on elsewhere.
Do you know anything about what efforts are made to collect these fines?
No, and again, I think he knows more about that than I do. I'm confined to what this record shows, and it doesn't obviously get into that. In what few minutes remain, I'd like to just address one additional point, and that is, I don't think there can legitimately be any question at all about the fact that these were proper fees of officers allowed by law that the statute allows us to tax. I think if there's a question raised in this case that can give us some concern, it's was the proper amount taxed in this case. And Mr. Martin has calculated, and I assume his calculations are fairly close to correct, that if you figure out the mileage back and forth to Waupun or wherever these were served, and you divide the charge by it, it's about 70 cents a mile. And we know the statute talks about 25 cents per mile. And again, my response with regard to that is clearly one of waiver. Because there was never any talk about whether 25 cents versus 70 cents was proper in the moving papers in the trial court. But more importantly, in the Court of Appeals, I specifically made the point that this was high, that this worked out to being something higher than the 25 cents allowed by the statute. And in the reply brief, there was never any, but I said we can assume that it was approved by the county board and therefore it was proper because of that section that follows on the heels of 81470, the 814705, which allows the county board to increase the rate. And there was never any response in the reply brief that said that was wrong or that he took issue with that. So while I think there may be some question here, I think it's a question that is not properly presented in this case, because that challenge was never made in either the trial court or the Court of Appeals, and it's really basically first here that we have that challenge made. So I just wanted to make that point clear. Other than that, I assume that we're talking in matters of seconds here left in my time, so I don't think there's any value in moving on to anything else. I'd entertain any additional questions the court might have, but in the absence of that,
thank you.
Yeah.
What do you think? What should this case, if I were going to write it or someone else on the call, what should we say is the rule of the law that you, the state, would like to see? Your time's up, but I would appreciate your help.
Well, I can sum it up by saying I think the rule of law should be the Court of Appeals' decision in this case. I don't think they made a misstep. I think, with the possible exception that when they were laying out the rules for judging the constitutionality of statutes, that kind of was beside the point, because there isn't a challenge, I don't think, here to the constitutionality of statutes. Unless they interpreted his concern about multiple prisoners and multiple charges as being a challenge to the Constitution and the statute, because the statute appears to allow the sheriff to impose this charge with respect to each service of process. But aside from that, they may slightly digress there from what the case was all about. But otherwise, I think they were right on the mark. You look at 973.06. You look at fees of officers authorized by law or whatever the magic language is. You look to 814.70 to fees of sheriffs, and you find these charges authorized. And with regard to the constitutional violations that were raised in the Court of Appeals, they were right on the money. And with respect to these additional issues about what should be the process in the trial court by which we assess costs, whether this 70 cents versus 25 cents is a problem, but those were all issues that were not raised in the Court of Appeals, and I don't think this court should encourage raising issues for the first time in this court when they could have been raised. If this 25 cents, 70 cents had been raised in the trial court, we could have, somebody with some knowledge of it could have produced some evidence as to whether or not, notwithstanding the fact that it doesn't appear to be anything in the county ordinances, is there a county, board resolution? We're just completely in the dark on that, but that's the reason I think why we require issues to be raised below, is because we want the courts below to be able to address them and to resolve any, factual disputes. We don't need any fact-finding here with respect to the issues that were raised. They were properly addressed by the Court of Appeals. And so the Court of Appeals decision is my suggested resolution of this case.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Martin.
Thank you. A judge in Milwaukee quotes her wise father as saying, never argue about a fact. There's a fact in this record that just can't be gotten around, and I try to avoid long quotes, and I'll make this very brief, but it's just not correct to say that these claims weren't advanced to the trial court. I'll refer the court to pages 6 and 7 of my reply brief, where I have the quote in much greater length. But I'm just going to read the concluding couple paragraphs of the defendant's last brief. The first paragraph, he says, it is not overstatement to characterize the approach of the authorities, paren, to the extent that any approach was made known to the court, and paren, as confusing at best and unfathomable at worst. No one has provided any explanation or justification for the costs imposed here. Indeed, the putative proponent of the fees of the sheriff, counsel for the sheriff, expressly declines to argue that they are proper costs to be assessed. The state has utterly failed to meet its burden to demonstrate that the costs are correct in fact and in law. Then it goes on to some more arguments. And finally, the last paragraph of the conclusion, this is the reply memorandum, which is record item 33, says, accordingly, the defendant renews his request that the court order the so-called warrant fee not be imposed, the judgment would be corrected, and so on. Alternatively, defendant requests that the court remit the warrant fee of $937.20 pursuant to its discretionary authority under Wisconsin Stats 973.06 sub 2. A clear request for the court to exercise discretion under the statute, which is referred to remit. Finally, alternatively, the defendant requests an evidentiary hearing at which the state, as the proponent of the warrant fees, would have the burden to demonstrate that they were appropriately assessed. The defendant, you can't say it's waiver when someone ignores your claims. These claims were made clearly. You can't say it's waiver when a judge issues a decision before the briefing schedule has expired and then ignores your reply brief.
You were just quoting from the trial court?
I'm quoting from a trial court memorandum.
Did you contest the fees of the Court of Appeals?
Yes. If you go on to, and this is where I refer to pages 6 and 7 of my reply brief, I have two lengthy quotes. One from the brief in chief in the Court of Appeals, which I did not author, page 19. Another from the reply brief in the Court of Appeals, pages 4 to 5. Both these quotes are at pages 6 and 7 of my reply brief in this court. So the fees were challenged in the trial court. They were challenged in the Court of Appeals. I feel like the thanks I get for abandoning untenable positions is to be accused of waiver for things that were clearly asserted. And these claims were asserted. That they weren't correct legally, that they weren't correct factually, that the proponent had a burden. All these things were asserted. And as is, unfortunately, the practice in Milwaukee, sometimes motions that should be heard get denied without a hearing. And then we have the record that this court confronts today, which is a muddle at best.
Well, you know, maybe you do deny that hearing can also be on paper, right?
Sure. Well,
if the trial court thinks that it doesn't need any further testimony and evidentiary matters, they can hear things in chambers, in effect, but on the record.
And there can be summary judgment and motion. I mean, all those things, if you have undisputed facts, or if you look at the facts in light most favorable to the claim, sure. But that's not what we have here. We have all, you know, facts all over the map. Facts I quoted in my brief the assumptions and the speculation the Court of Appeals had to indulge in to get to the result that they did.
You promised us a citation to a Court of Appeals.
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
Grant. Grant.
Okay.
168 with second 682. 168 with second 682, 484, Northwest second 370. Grant is a different subsection of 973.06, but it concerns payment for attorney's fees. And there's particular language in that subsection, which I think is 973.06 sub 1E. And the language in that subsection says, if the court determines at the time of sentencing the defendant's circumstances have changed. And the Court of Appeals made very clear, and it was there's no petition for review filed here. This was it makes very clear that if you don't deal with this at sentencing, you can't come back later and ask for the costs. So there's at least a suggestion there, and I think there's a suggestion in the scheme of 973.06, this is a sentencing matter, because the cost will either be stand alone because there is no restitution, in which case there's a 6-month penalty, or they'll be folded into other the restitution itself, and then it can be collected over years to come. And I will just reassert that I know that the institutions are very aggressive about deducting costs. I have to deal with the fact that Yolanda Spears has been reassessed costs after her resentencing. This court granted resentencing. She's been hit with costs twice now to get that straightened out. They do aggressively collect them.
Thank you. Mr. Martin. On behalf of the court, I want to thank both of you for excellent arguments, and not only today, but in the future.